to order this hearing of the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee. And I will ask the clerk to note the roll. And I would like to take this opportunity, first of all, to welcome two of our three new members. Senator Carlson has been appointed to this committee. One of our three new members. The other two are not here. Senator Sieben is lobbying for high-speed rail in
Washington.
In Washington for the commission that she is a member of. And our other new member is Senator Olsen, who has just arrived and is in the room. We certainly have, and for the rest of you, I'd like to welcome you back to the legislature, obviously, and also to your service on this committee. We have seen a lot of interest in election law changes and election experience in this last election, and we're going to start the legislative session in this committee with two separate hearings. We decided to divide them more or less by a timeline, and that is today's hearing will focus on the election experience up until and including the day of the election itself, November 4th, 2008. The hearing on Friday will then take up our experiences after Election Day, that is, the issues that have come about and come to the state's attention and certainly the legislature's attention following the recount and of the U.S. Senate race and ongoing discussions about and actions about who is going to become the second senator from Minnesota. So we've asked people, some people will be testifying on both days, but we've asked people today to limit their comments and focus their comments on the experiences leading up to Election Day and on Friday to talk about the experiences of the recount, and including we will have extensive discussion on Friday about the whole issue of absentee ballots, and that will not be a topic of discussion today, except incidentally, I suppose. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome to the committee Secretary of State Mark Ritchie. Mr. Secretary, if you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Mark Ritchie, Secretary of State, and I'm joined with joined here today with Beth Frazier, our Director of Government Affairs.
Yes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, last January and last February, the turnout at the caucuses and primaries around the country signaled that we would have perhaps the biggest election in our lifetime, and at the same moment, your committee and others and the full legislative bodies were passing some important changes in Minnesota election law, which were part of our implementation plan and our activities during the course of the year. A couple that come to mind that had great success, one was new measures to enable our soldiers and other military personnel and others overseas to vote. And one result of that was we had a 400% increase, four times as many people were able to vote from overseas, so this was a real important success. We have a lot more progress to be made, but that was a great step forward. We also passed legislation where we allowed anyone who was eligible voter to be an election judge, not just members who publicly declared their membership in a major political party. So independent people from the Green Party, others, and that helped both broaden the base of people active as election judges, but also helped us to lower the average age a little bit and to bring some new people into the process. During the course of the year, our department, working with many others in the community, created a number of new services for voters. There was a very special website built for overseas voters, which many people made use of, and we got a lot of praise and comments from people around the planet. a lot of new literature, both aimed at voters and also at candidates, and especially at candidates who sometimes don't know all the rules, for example, independent candidates or candidates of minor parties. So we did a full range of new literature, and that also gave us the information we needed to produce new videos and training materials that were available and used extensively at the local level, township, county, small towns, and cities. This process included the upgrading and adding of new features to our statewide voter registration system, SVRS, we often call it. A lot of the local election officials and city clerks and county auditors had a number of very excellent suggestions, and they range from do what you can to make it go faster to can't we all have access to certain of the features that had formerly just been available to some of the larger cities, that kind of thing. We also continue to enhance the use of our poll finder tool. Some of you might remember that the night of the precinct caucuses, I think we had, I don't know, something like nearly a quarter of a million people made use of it in the to find their precinct caucus, but it was very heavily used for the elections itself, both the primary. There were also a number of new services that we developed as part of this election year in preparation for what we knew would be a very big election. One, we had a lot of meeting with our different advisory groups, and one in particular that comes to mind was our disability voter advisory groups. We know that among our citizens and our neighbors who have a much more difficult time voting are our neighbors who have limited vision or blind, limited hearing or deaf, or perhaps have a physical disability. And one of the things we discovered that transportation was their number one priority for addressing. We were able to work with some of the local corporations to put together some services to help provide additional transportation for disabled voters. This was a big success and very exciting and gives us information for going forward. A lot of the companies that we work with, Target comes to mind, were active in recruiting election judges from among their employees, particularly their younger employees, paying their salary during the day, helping us expand that base. There was a new voter registration card, and we'll have examples of that for you, but we went from the old version to the new version. People have been very happy about that. But that also gave us the opportunity to really upgrade some of our verification mechanism. Some of you know that for the past few years before I came into office, we were under some heavy pressure from the Department of Justice because we need to go through Department of Public Safety to the Social Security system in Washington, and that electronic computer-based connection wasn't up to the standards. In fact, we had to go through Iowa to do this. But anyhow, in this last year, we were able to establish our direct connection to the Social Security network through Department of Public Safety, got Department of Justice off our backs, and that allowed us to improve our systems of verification. Some of you know that with a new registration, the first step that happens is there's a whole string of things that happen in terms of verifications. There's four levels, and you're trying to determine through Social Security system in Washington, are they who they say they are. Department of Public Safety is using their records from driver's licenses to determine if they're a citizen or not, or if they have on their license of, an expiration date of their visa, in which case they would not be a citizen. We work with the courts to determine if somebody is a felon or still on paper, on parole or probation. And we're going to be coming back to you and talking to you about expanding that authority so we can also work with Department of Corrections because we need more sources of information. And, of course, everyone registering gets a non-forwardable postal card as a part of the verification. If it comes back to us, then we flag them, they're challenged, but it's just part of our system. The new voter registration form has really helped us to move that process along, in addition to the help that we receive from Department of Public Safety and everyone else who cooperates to make the verification as successful as it is. We had a primary election. You know, no big surprise, it was much smaller than the general election, but it resulted in a statewide recount. And I know we're not supposed to talk about recounts today, but it was a blessing in disguise that we had a very close race in a state Supreme Court race. Fortunately, our Department of Elections, our chief elections official, Gary Poser, suspected there would be a recount. He made arrangements with the local officials before. And at some point in the night, I did hear a big groan go up down in our election division, so I knew that that race had fallen within the half a percent. We were able to do that recount in less than 3 days, extremely fast. A lot of grumbling at the moment, but it turned out to be a very good run-through to make sure our system worked. And what was important about that system is it's based on the cooperation between our office and the local election officials. Mr. Poser also guessed correctly that there would be a recount in the general election. He made arrangements with local election officials to engage their support and cooperation if there was a recount. It turned out he was true. But the primary was a relatively light turnout, which gave us the possibility of doing that recount very quickly, very efficiently. And then we had the general election. Biggest number of people ever to vote, 2.92 million, almost 2.93 now that we've done the recount. We didn't quite reach our 80% of eligible voters. We were at 78. But again, number one in the nation, 5 percentage points above the number two state, Wisconsin. And in that election, there were some significant new factors. I noted that we had a huge increase of voters from overseas, 400%. We also had a doubling of absentee voting from 06 to 08. We also had a kind of interesting phenomena where there was huge turnout in the morning, a lot of news coverage of the turnout, and then relatively light turnout afternoons and evenings, and some anecdotal evidence that the large media coverage did discourage some people who just felt like their knees were not able to take standing in line and they could see the lines in the morning and they didn't come in the afternoon. We have not had a minute to really think or interview or ask people in depth, but we do want to look more deeply as we can into some of the other things that we could learn from this year's election about, you know, kind of voter patterns and how people chose to vote. And is it going to be the case that we're going to be very heavy in the mornings and light in the afternoon, or was that just a kind of unusual circumstance based on this year? There are a lot of things that we've learned in the run-up to this process and a lot of things that we learned in the elections that we think we can bring to the issue of saving money for local governments. It's clear that a more automatic system of voter registration can save millions of dollars to local governments, and we want to go back to that topic. We've talked about it before. You're going to hear some other ideas from local election officials. I myself am going to be out in the regions, in the counties first to thank people for this incredible public service they've done in this recount, incredible contribution of people's time and energy. But second, to ask people for their ideas. We have our ideas kind of in the center. We talk to local election officials all the time, but I want to get out and hear from the election clerks, the voters, the people who had to bring their mothers to the poll, who needed transportation. What are all those ideas that people have? We're going to continue to lead the nation in turnout. We're going to continue to lead the nation in election administration. But we're also a state that's changing demographically, how we work, how we play, how we live. So many of us are overseas or traveling. Many of us now get up early and drive long distances to make sure we have work. Lots of things happening in Minnesota. We need to bring our system and keep making it as modern as our lifestyle is. It was an incredible year to be in election administration. I have several years ago, and much to my staff's chagrin, volunteered Minnesota to host the National Association of Secretaries of State conference this year because I knew we would be number one and I thought we could brag. I did not know that we might have another subject that would be of high interest, and I can tell you that the secretaries from all over the country, those who've been through close recounts like my good friend Sam Reed, who's secretary in Washington State, and others who fear recounts, have been calling and saying, what can we learn from your experience? And the thing that I say is that I inherited this incredible system, paper ballots and optical scan machines, a state constitution that was smart enough to put in a state canvassing board. But local elected officials who, in partnership with our office, are dedicated to making sure that we can handle the kind of historically high turnout and we can handle two statewide recounts in a row if we have to, although we don't want to, and that we can come out with the kind of information that can help us make a great system even better going forward. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and I'll take any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Are there questions or comments for Secretary Ritchie? Senator Roebling and then Vickerman.
Thank you. Mr. Ritchie, I'm wondering, I had a friend who was in Iraq, and he thought he had applied early enough to get an absentee ballot that would include the local races and was disappointed that he got a much more generic ballot. Were there problems in that area getting those ballots back to servicemen?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, I don't know the particular county, but most of the service people that I heard from applied and received their ballots by email, and so it was the full local ballot, and they were able to print it out and then fill it in and mail it back or use. There was a special arrangement with FedEx. But it's certainly the case that if something happened very late, generally that federal overseas absentee ballot with just the lines, which was what we called the presidential or federal ballot, might have been the only thing that was still available to them. But are they permanently in Iraq or just there were on a temporary basis?
September through the end of December.
Yeah. I would love to get more details just about the county because these things are done generally at the county level, and so I could follow up because one of the things we want to do is really make sure that our systems are working, you know, in every instance that we can. So I really will appreciate – I'll contact your office and get some more details on that.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Bickerman?
Well, Madam Chair, just a quick question. Mr. Ritchie, do you have any way of telling how many minorities like Hispanics and Latinos in my rural Minnesota district voted absentee or voted at regular day?
Mr. Secretary?
Madam Chair, Senator Bickerman, it's possible that some on absentees, it may be possible to look at last names and do some rough things, but it's not something that we would typically know in that way. But because of so much attention that's been given to absentees, it would certainly be possible to know, like, generic numbers, you know, within your area. And then by looking at last names, you might be able to make, you know, some guesstimates. But I've been asking for and have not yet received some of the exit polling data, which would not apply to absentees because, you know, exit polling is more the people there. But to find out more generally, especially about younger voters and older voters and that kind of thing, and the minute we have it, I want to be able to get it out to people. But as to how we might apply that or understand it in relationship to absentee, I think I don't know enough, you know, to be able to give you an answer that would have some basis without just, you know, making a guess based on last names or something like that.
Thank you.
Senator Carlson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Secretary, can you give me a feel for what kinds of filtering you do for names and accuracy of voters that are in the state voter file?
Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, well, there's four forms of verification that we use, and so you know, going through Department of Public Safety up to Social Security and back is one of the most important ones. Checking status with driver's license about citizenship and with the court systems about felon. And then we mail a postal verification card to make sure it's a legitimate address, legitimate person, that kind of thing. But we've also introduced and this was thanks to a big change in the law that was made and some other procedures we've been doing, using the U.S. Postal Service's change of address forms. During this past period, we've been able to automatically fill with what the Postal Service has as the exact spelling and address and that kind of thing. So I'm partially interested in these issues, to be quite frank, because as a politician who runs for office, we all want really accurate lists. We don't want bad names, bad spellings, bad addresses, none of that. And it's one of the huge advantages of an automatic voter registration system that would be, you know, in addition to the cost savings at the local level. But I feel like we're, you know, constantly in the business of updating and trying to bring those things into more, you know, as accurate as they can be. But it would be a very good question to ask the county folks who are actually the ones who do the data. You know, the Office of Secretary of State sort of hosts the system, and our computer programmers build the system. We connect to the other agencies. We connect to the Postal Service, change of address. but it's at the county level that the data and the, you know, that kind of information. And I think you'll have the top people in the state here, and this would be a very good question to ask them about how those systems have changed and have improved over the years.
Mm-hmm. One follow-up.
Senator Carlson.
For instance, now, if there is a situation where there are, let's say, multiple addresses for one name, do you do any filtering of that, any routine runs of duplicate names or duplicate addresses, things like that?
Mr. Secretary.
Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, it would be a very good question to ask the local folks because it's in their area. Occasionally, when we see the systems for the change of address from the U.S. government, we're beginning to see that there may be some more automated ways to do that, but no person has more than one registration in the system that's part of their active voter file. But people are, you know, there are other registrations that people have, but they're not part of what is the active voter file. So,
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Secretary. I just want to thank you and the canvassing board for the good work and the hard work that you did. It was very clear that you ran a very open, transparent process, a fair process. And I wanted to mention that you recommended that I show my students the movie Recount, and we did that. And I'm sorry to report that I don't think Hollywood is going to be making a movie about your efforts here.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Secretary, I had read somewhere that you estimated there was about 135,000 people that do not have, like, a Minnesota ID card or any kind of photo ID, and I thought that kind of struck me as a large number. I can believe that a true number is senior citizens lose their ability to drive. They may not apply for an ID card or a Minnesota ID card or something. Do you have any ramifications to close that number?
Mr. Secretary.
Madam Chair, Senator Olsen, I think the number is a lot higher than that. And, you know, we don't think of it as our job to help people get driver's license or anything like that. So I guess my answer to your question is no. But there's a tremendous number of people who don't have state-issue IDs in Minnesota and in all states. And it's just part of how people live in their life, young people. And I had a niece in New York. It took her 2 years to get a ID because of a variety of different things. So I think it's not as simple as, you know, we all think about it, but it's not in the sort of work of our agency to, you know, to think about that or, you know, take responsibility for that. I have to say that it's been very important that we've been able to build much deeper and broader relationships with Department of Public Safety and the Driver's License Bureau and the other agencies. And, you know, we maintain almost the largest database of Minnesotans, and Department of Public Safety in the driver's licenses maintains a very large database of Minnesotans. And so there are different things that we could do as state agencies in cooperation that might help some people who truly want that ID and maybe have had some problems getting it. But we haven't moved into those conversations as much as we've been trying to get our computers to talk to each other more in a more friendly way, and then to have those computers talk to Washington. We haven't moved beyond what I would call just the sort of logistical connections between our agencies towards problem solving, you know, of some kind. But I would welcome, you know, ideas and initiatives on that part. I do feel like we are getting close to being able to make sure all of our computers can talk to each other on these vital matters like verification of citizenship and stuff like that. But we haven't gone any further.
Senator Gimsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Talking about this, the system that you use, that you go through public safety and then to verification of Social Security numbers, what system, as far as the federal government and the Social Security Department, do you use? Do you use the E-Verify type of system, or is it, because we've all heard the horror stories of the ineffectiveness at times of E-Verify, mm-hmm. and also the stories about identity theft, dealing with Social Security numbers and things like that. What system do you use, and do you consider it to be better than
Mr. Secretary?
Madam Chair, Senator Gimsey. We just do what the Help America Vote Act, the federal government, tells us we have to do, which is we deal with Department of Public Safety. They deal with the SSN, Social Security Center in Washington, and they're just basically verifying the information. The concerns that you were expressing about bad data, do we know how our privacy is checked, those are things that really bother me. But anyhow, it's in the federal law, and they were on our backs for years to make it. We had to go through Iowa for a couple years. So they actually are providing the least useful verification data. It's like, does this person exist? Well, we've heard of somebody like that person. You know, it's not like the driver's license, where if somebody has a visa and they're not a citizen, we have that information direct. But it's in the federal law, and we comply with the federal law, and we are very happy that DPS made some change in their computer so it could be direct instead of through Iowa. But that's about all that we've gotten to on this.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gimsey.
Mr. Secretary, it bothers me, too, that the opportunity is out there to the extent that it is out there for not just identity theft but also voter fraud through these systems. And you know, hopefully we can work towards something even better in the future.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Secretary Ritchie, I wanted to ask a question about the recount. I know your official capacity is done at this stage with the canvassing board.
Senator Gerlach, he is coming back on Friday. We've divided these hearings into up to and including Election Day, and then Friday's hearing is going to be on the recount and on recount issues and the whole area of absentee ballots and so forth. So if your question deals with that, if you could wait. Senator, the Secretary is coming back.
Okay, we'll do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Fraser, did you have anything to add?
No, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you very much. I would next like to invite Ms. Cindy Reichert and Ms. Rachel Smith, who are respectively the elections directors of the City of Minneapolis and the elections supervisor of Anoka County. Welcome to the committee. And if you would, we'd be pleased to hear your testimony, and if you would identify yourself before you begin to speak.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Cindy Reichert. I'm the Director of Elections with the City of Minneapolis. And Rachel and I are here together because we have many shared experiences. Rachel does deal with things on the county level, where I deal primarily on the city level, so she can speak more to some of the registration types of issues, and I can talk about some of our Election Day issues as well. But I think I'm going to have Rachel go first because she's going to be talking about things that we all did across the state, or most of us anyway, so.
Ms. Smith.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Rachel Smith. I'm the Anoka County Elections Manager. And basically, I just prepared just a short statement to talk about a little bit about what we expected on Election Day. We were bracing ourselves for a large turnout. As Secretary Ritchie pointed out, we saw a huge turnout with the caucuses. And as a result of that, we put many hours of preparation ahead so that we could prepare. And just to give you an example of some of the things, some of the small details that can really help a voter on Election Day include things like adding extra voting booths to a precinct, you know, so that voters have more spots to go to. We can hire extra election judges, including what's called a greeter judge, to help get voters put in the right spot, make sure they're in the right location before they get into any kind of a line or before they get into, they know if they're registered or they need to register on Election Day. We also split the pre-registered roster book, you know, the one that many of you are probably familiar with signing when you go in, into smaller alpha groupings so that you can make that line a little smaller. And also to include, you know, hiring extra people to register people on Election Day. So those are some of the small details that we can do administratively to help ease Election Day for the voters. We also ordered extra ballots. Many of us ordered 200% of what we thought was of our registered voters to make sure that in no case did we run out of ballots. We ordered extra supplies, and many of us prepared sample ballots.
Ms. Smith, did that work?
Madam Chair, yes.
Did anyone run out of ballots across the state?
Madam Chair, my understanding,
that you're aware of?
Not that I'm aware of. I did not hear any reports. Usually we do get rumors or someone will sort of fess up to it if it happens, but for the most part, I heard good things. The Secretary of State might be able to address that better. But also, our voting equipment malfunctions were quite minimal, so we had very little complaints of voting machines going down. Our optical scanners were working great. We were happy about that as well. What kind of challenges did we have? Well, I would say one of the challenges that many of us agree upon is the issue with the challengers versus a poll watcher. And many of the political party, both political parties appointed what were called challengers. And different information was given to each of the challengers. They had different roles that they were expected to do. And in some cases put our election judges in kind of a battle between the two and the polling place. And so we have some concerns about defining those roles more clearly, that we don't have poll watchers in Minnesota.
Could you distinguish what that, the difference between poll watchers, which we do not have, that they do have in other states, and challengers, and then give some examples, if you would, about what kinds of behaviors were frustrating to election judges by the challengers?
Sure, Madam Chair. First of all, the difference between a challenger and a poll watcher is this. In Minnesota, our law specifically says that you have the right to be there, but to challenge the voter eligibility. So you're only there to challenge an eligibility criteria of a voter.
Which would be
age, citizenship. But not only that, it has to be based on personal knowledge. So it's a very limited scope on what that role is. But we heard from our election judges, and I also received reports on election day, that many of the challengers thought their scope was beyond that, that they could converse with voters, that they could be advocates for voters, that they could, in one case I had one of the challengers telling me I didn't know how to do my job because we were going to process absentee ballots prior to 8 p.m., yelling at me, yelling at the judges. So I think that there was some disturbing behavior from our end that we want to make sure that we don't put our election judges in a position where they're feeling like they need to mediate.
And the rule for counting absentee ballots during election day, what is that process, by the way?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, there is a particular statute that refers to after 8 p.m., but only in a certain circumstance, like a vacancy or there was a
supplemental ballot.
There was a supplemental ballot. Thank you. That was the word. This is why we're together. So if there was a supplemental ballot provided rather than otherwise, the law is not particular on when the absentee ballots are processed.
And so they could be processed in the afternoon or in the morning or whenever they were delivered to the precinct election judges from whichever central location they had been collected. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And as long as a voter who has voted absentee comes in and in person and votes before the absentee ballots are opened, that absentee ballot is set aside. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is correct. In fact, we oftentimes encourage our election judges to process midday or mid-afternoon when it's slow because leaving that to the very end of the day can often be daunting when they're trying to close up the precinct.
I'd like to say a few words about challengers, too, if I might.
Certainly, Ms. Riker.
We had many, many challengers in Minneapolis. Every one of our 131 precincts had challengers, most from both parties throughout the day, which
Do they have to be, like, certified by a party, or can somebody walk in off the street and say, I'm going to be a challenger?
Madam Chair, a challenger does need to present to the head election judge their letter appointing them as a challenger from the party or from the candidate.
It can be campaigns as well as the party, as a party. Is that correct?
One per party, mm-hmm. per precinct.
Okay.
But there can also be nonpartisan candidates can also appoint a challenger, as well as groups advocating for or against a ballot question. The challengers presented a big problem administratively in terms of answering all the phone calls related to the behavior of the challengers. I do have a couple of quotes from our election judges. I'll just read one of them here. Two challengers, very confrontational and argumentative with each other. The judges essentially turn into referees in some cases. So I think some additional restrictions on the behavior of the challengers in the precincts might be in order. Also, I did attend training for both parties' challengers and noted that they were specifically instructed in some cases not to challenge any voters, but rather to be there to watch the other challenger or to make sure the election judges are doing things correctly. And my feeling personally, and I think a lot of people share this opinion, that if it would greatly improve the quality of our election judges if the persons who are so interested in making sure things are going correctly in the precinct actually serve as election judges rather than challengers, to be certainly trained from the inside and understand all the procedures and rules. And certainly we want people who are interested to be participating in that way. So I think you'll see some things coming forward in the future about, putting more limitations on the behavior and also something like a registration, formal training from election administrators rather than from the parties prior to serving as a challenger. But we'll see that unfold as we go through these talks.
Ms. Smith, did you have some further comments for us?
Madam Chair, just a couple other small ones. One issue we did hear from some voters, we were receiving complaints that they're that employers were requiring or limiting the time off on the morning of election day. They were putting time frames, an hour, for allowing only an hour for them to go, so they felt to go and vote in the morning rather than just however long it may have taken in some cases. But we did receive several complaints regarding that. And then I think the other big challenge we have sometimes is getting the voters prepared. How can we best get them where they need to go, their polling location? What will they see on the ballot? And are they registered or not registered? We are seeing that voters aren't sure. They're not sure if they're registered, so they're sending in additional voter registration cards, or they just don't know. And I think on our end, we do have some interest in empowering the voters to be able to get this information more, I guess, easier than it is now. And then also information on the candidates, the judicial candidates, the soil and water, the county. They're confused, and they're coming to us with answers we can't give them. So with that, I'll reserve the time for questions. But
Ms. Smith, you shared with me an example of how the technology of the system that the secretary described allowed you to immediately see that a voter had supposedly voted twice. I wonder if you would share that story here and how the system allowed you to find that out.
Madam Chair, the...
It's the story about the college student.
Right. Yeah. Madam Chair, the... when we get all of our Election Day registrations in, or when we get a voter registration card in, what we do is we enter it into a statewide voter registration system, which the statewide voter registration system allows us to see all the registrations. So I can see if someone is registered in Hennepin. I can see if maybe they had a previous registration in St. Louis County. And so what happens is I will, to update that registration, I have to select or highlight their previous registration. And if they had been recorded to have voting history, which those roster books, they all have barcodes. And we immediately, within 6 weeks after the election, we have already barcoded any time there's been a signature on that pre-registration and record voting history for the voter. So if I'm entering an Election Day registration, for example, I can see if this person had voting history for that election already. And then I immediately contact Hennepin County or St. Louis County if I see there's been double voting history posted and ask if they can send me their documents. And then I send them ours, and we send it up to the county attorney for investigation. The particular instance, story that I shared was from 2006, in which that we had a mother who filled out a absentee ballot application on behalf of her daughter and voted the ballot under her daughter's name. But then the daughter didn't know about it, so went to college in Stearns or St. Cloud and registered on election day. And, of course, we found it because there was double voting history posted, and it was immediately sent to the county attorney for investigation. And my understanding is it's been prosecuted out now. So they charged the mother. But this was one case. This is the one and only case in 2006 that we had out of 170,000 people voting on Election Day.
Thank you. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, my son was in college in South Dakota, voted absentee in Minnesota. Is there any way that anyone would know if he had also voted in South Dakota? Is there any crossover check that they can do on a federal level?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, I think the Secretary of State's office would be better to answer that because they do some of the internal cross-checking state by state. So there is a process, I believe, that happens with the between the states and registration. But to the intricacies, I do not know that because I deal with the statewide information.
To trust your son to be honest.
No, Madam Chair, I know my son didn't do that because he didn't register in time in South Dakota, and you have to register 2 weeks ahead, and there's no same-day registration, which kept him here in Minnesota because he was registered here previously. But I was just wondering, you know, if there would be a way to detect that if students decided to do that, because we do let them choose whichever address they want, their home parent address or their current residence at the college where they're attending.
Senator Betzel, then Senator Carlson.
Just a question. You obviously are going to run into people who have common surnames or even maybe say an Asian surname where you don't know if it's the first name or the last name, and so sometimes it could be reversed by the election judge that doesn't know which comes first and last. How do you sort out that to figure out if there's any double voting?
Ms. Smith?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, well, there's a lot of different ways that we can do that. I can share a story. We have a father and son who have exactly the same name, and they have different date of births, but they were registered prior to 1983, so they only have they don't have a year of birth. They only have the month and the day. And they were contacted prior to Election Day, accused of being double voters. And they contacted me regarding this, and they explained to me what the situation was, and we were able to pull their voter registration cards from prior to 1983 to show the signatures were different, the handwriting is different. There's different ways. In Anoka County, we image all of our voter registration applications, so once you have filled out a voter registration card, we have that on image on file, and we can go back and take a look at previous ones, or we could look at different names to see if the handwriting there's all sorts of different things we can do. Remember, we also have the pre-registered roster signatures. We have to look at handwriting. We also have the new registrant roster. If someone registers on Election Day, they fill out kind of a whole line of information. And usually it's pretty easy to tell comparing those if you've got two people that registered on Election Day. They might have a similar name, but it's pretty easy to tell the difference between their handwriting.
Senator Betzel?
But the other part, we have a number of people who have names that, you know, are not, you know, European-based. You know, I mean, somebody might make Chang Bao, and they might just reverse the names because they don't know which one is first and which one is last, and it might show up in one county as one set of names, and the same names just reversed in the other county because they don't know. I mean, if things like that happen, is there any way that, you know, people can figure out, you know, that this is the same person we're talking about unless you really dig deep into it?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, well, I think one of the most advancements that we've made is certainly with the driver's license number and the last four digits of the Social Security number. Those are really helpful tools for us sometimes if we think that they might be the same person. If they have the same driver's license, that helps us out quite a bit too. And a lot of times voters will also put their previous registration information, so we do search under that as well.
Thank you.
Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair, and I believe Ms. Reichert, or actually it's a question for the room here, you were talking about the challengers, and I've heard a lot of those stories also about challengers, and sometimes they behave badly. For election judges, I'm wondering, is it in statute that they have to go through the training before they can be an election judge? And if it's rulemaking, can we also have the challengers go through training before they can be a challenger?
Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, yes, the election judge training is included in statutes. There's minimum numbers of hours, curriculum that must be taught, and there is nothing currently about challengers. That may be something that we wish to add some requirements for that as well.
Ms. Riker.
I just have a few other issues about Elections Day that I'd like to bring up. It was a very busy day, and in Minneapolis, we had 209,000 voters vote that day. We had 50,505 same-day registrations. So we did end up with some long lines at some of our precincts, and I would hope that some of the changes that the Secretary of State has put forward regarding registration and how we register voters could certainly ease some of the burden of Election Day registrations, which essentially go very well. It's just that they are time-consuming, and they do cause lines to back up. It is a wonderful service to our voters, though. Many people change their address, update their registrations on Election Day. So we certainly want to see that continue, but would like to see, you know, a little bit of relief. And I'm sure that things that the Secretary's office is proposing would help out with that. Some other things just very minor on Election Day. I think that we will be bringing forward just some suggestions for example, repealing the requirement for election judges to initial the ballots. It's time-consuming. When you have 3,000 ballots in a precinct to be writing initials, there's it's kind of a hanger-on from the past, from when we did have paper ballots that people were putting into boxes. There are other measures to maintain ballot security and integrity in our current environment that we use. So that's one thing. There are some other very minor fixes that we'll be bringing forward. Such as allowing judges to check the ballot box during the day. Our current law says between 1 and 3 that the judges can open the ballot box and remove ballots. Well, with the equipment that we do use, it's just necessary to do it many times during the day to ensure that ballots aren't getting jammed up, they're falling correctly. And we'd like that law to be changed to mix with our common practice that we must use to keep things moving in the precinct. So I just wanted to bring a couple of things to your attention and hope that you consider these things as we move forward. I'm sure there's going to be quite a bit of reform for the city of Minneapolis and for many of the cities. I think much of what you're going to be hearing on Friday is going to be the meat of what we want to take care of in the next session and speak to you about. And also, if you have any questions for me, I'd be happy to answer them.
Are there further questions for Ms. Reichert or Ms. Smith? Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair, this would be for either of you. I voted in our precinct. I used the touch screen, and, of course, it didn't work. So I was just wondering if you guys had problems with those throughout your areas.
The auto marks are very heavily used in Minneapolis precincts, and for the most part, they do work well. There have been some issues with them, and they are still new in the precincts, and I think as people use them more, certainly they're going to use the technology more efficiently. But there have been some issues with them not working, screens not advancing, et cetera. Just this last election, I got a tip from one of the vendors that I was able to pass along that I didn't even know about operation of the equipment before. So I think there's a learning curve when you have any new equipment that we're all going to be learning more as we move forward. But the auto marks are very appreciated, especially by the disabled voters who are able to vote privately and independently.
Senator Carlson?
Yep. Madam Chair and Ms. Reichert, I have another question about the voting day and the length of time that the judges are expected to serve. What time do they start? Give me a little feel for what the day is like, how long it is, and how often they're relieved, and whether you have different shifts, and what time of day do they close out things?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, the election judges in Minneapolis, we ask to be at their precinct by 6 a.m. The doors open at 6 a.m. Voters arrive at 7. The day is very long for our election day, our election judges. Some of them came back on this last election day well after midnight. I think our last precinct came in at 2:30 in the morning. We ask a great deal of our election judges. And again, I think some of the things that we're going to be talking about regarding absentee ballots, which generally are processed, even though they can do it earlier in the day, in a busy election day, they're not able to get to those until later. Certainly, with the increase in the volume in the absentees, that's added a lot of work. I think we ask too much of our judges at this point. But that being said, in Minneapolis, we have about 2,000 election judges. Some of them we allow to work shifts. However, that's not our preferred because of the continuity throughout the day, for one thing, and also just the scheduling, logistical scheduling nightmares that could present with the large volume that we have. Most of our election judges have been working for many years. With the change in the law last year, where we're now able to hire nonpartisan election judges, we received many, many new judges. And as Secretary Ritchie said, it did lower the average age of our election judges. I think more and more people also are very excited to serve as a judge. And this is something that's been very positive, that it's come out of all the scrutiny in the past few years about elections in general. As many more people are interested in serving. So in Minneapolis, we started in 2006 actually doing performance evaluations on our judges. Those are used to evaluate whether we want to rehire those judges. And using tools like that and really treating it as a professional position with certain job requirements in excess of those included in statutes really help us to improve the quality of the election judge workforce. And I think we're on a very good trend there in our state, so feel good about that.
Senator Roebling, and then we'll move on.
Thank you. In my area, the voter turnout was, 100% plus because we have so many new residents and they weren't on the registration list. But they did have quite a rush at the polls. And it's my understanding that some of them would have a big room like this, and they had the voting booths lined up along the wall. But in between, there were tables and chairs set up. And they let people, they'd say, if you're comfortable, you can stay in this room and vote, and you don't have to wait for a booth to open. And there is nothing in our law, is there, that prohibits them from doing that? Is there anything that says they have to stay within visual sight of judges or anything? I think everybody did stay in those larger rooms, but do we have enough flexibility to allow everybody to try and accommodate large crowds like that?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Roebling. Yes, in many areas we do have space to put up tables. We encourage our election judges to do that. We want to keep people moving through the polling place. People do not leave the polling place with their ballot. Unless there's, if they leave with a ballot, they can't come back. So they may have signed in and left in a huff. That could happen. But we do encourage people to sit wherever they can. We certainly offer them that opportunity so that we can keep things moving. Only one person at a time can use the ballot counter, though. So you do try to control the traffic coming into the room. You want to keep a sense of calm. What we did in Minneapolis, and I'm sure many jurisdictions did the same, we held the line of voters outside the room wherever possible. We had greeter judges who worked that line to make sure everybody was in the right place. They were either registered or were given a clipboard and a registration form that they could complete before they enter the voting room. Once they're in that voting room, it moves fairly quickly, and especially if we can provide them with places to fill out their ballot other than a voting booth, we can keep people moving through at a faster pace.
Senator Roebling, in my precinct, the election judges offered the
offered the choice. They said you can either, because there's a lot of people, you can sit at the, it was in a cafeteria in a school, you can sit at the lunch table and fill out the ballot, or if you prefer to wait for the voting booth, you certainly may do that as well. And so there were four of us, you know, constantly, clearly, using the lunchroom tables and the, and that's what I did, lunchroom table in the cafeteria to vote. I didn't need to stand in the voting booth. But they offered that as an they didn't say go there. They just said if you would like to, you can sit at the cafeteria table and vote. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Smith and Ms. Reichert, and I'm sure we'll be hearing from you again.
Thank you.
I would now like to invite Keisha Gaskins, the Executive Director for the League of Women Voters Minnesota. And does everybody have this? Mm-hmm. Members, you have in your packets the written statement from the League of Women Voters.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Keisha Gaskins. I'm the Executive Director for the League of Minnesota. As you're aware, LWV Minnesota is a nonpartisan organization that has participated in the informed and active participation of voters in this state for 89 years. We continued that proud tradition in the 2008 election. We hosted over 175 debates. We provided almost 500,000 voter guides, printed voter guides, across the state of Minnesota. We had an online voter guide, and we hosted a voter information hotline on September 8th and September 9th, and on November 3rd and 4th, as we have for the past 10 years. My testimony today will be focused on the information that we received on November 3rd and November 4th on the for the general election. In addition to the tens of thousands of hits on our website, through our voter information hotline and our state office, we received over 5,000 phone calls between November 3rd and November 4th, seeking information about how to vote. Over half these calls were primarily voters seeking to find their polling location. That was almost every, that was the vast majority of the calls. The next largest category of calls were people seeking information on same-day registration information. Some of those people were, had simply missed the October 14th deadline. Other people had moved since and needed information, and others were simply unfamiliar with same-day voter registration process, and we provided that information. We also, unfortunately, got a significant number of phone calls from people who had registered by the October 14th deadline, but up until the day of election still hadn't received their blue confirmation card, or people who had attempted to go to vote, then their names weren't on the list, and they called to notify us of that problem. For those who had adequate information, adequate identification to register on the day, we used information provided by the Secretary of State, and they were able to register on that day. But for those who had pre-registered but didn't have proper information to register on that day from their location, they were unable to vote, and their right to vote was nullified. We had people who had moved in advance, and they didn't have anyone to vouch for them, and they were also denied their right to vote. There were other callers that were unclear as to what constituted a rent statement, and in one case, an election judge who was unwilling to accept a valid rent statement as adequate proof for same-day registration, and we sent that voter back and told them to try again. And they went back and called us back and let us know that they were, in fact, able to vote, but we were concerned that they didn't feel empowered to do so until they called our office to be validated that they, in fact, done what they were supposed to do. We received many calls surrounding absentee voting. Although these calls diminished closer we came to Election Day, our voter information hotline did field a number of calls from nursing homes and hospitals, from doctors and nurses and families of loved ones of people who had fallen ill or become injured and needed to vote. There is a procedure for people who are suddenly and unable to make it to their polling location, but it's an extremely cumbersome process. And for anyone who was hospitalized a far enough distance away from their primary location, that process is entirely unworkable. It is impossible to get someone to get an agency form, to get back to the county, take that form with the agency back to the voter, get the ballot, come back, get the ballot, and get it back by 2 o'clock that afternoon. And so we had to tell people who had called, you know, by noon or 1 o'clock, it's like there's no feasible way you're going to be able to get through this process. So if there was a way to make to have it more centralized, for people who are trying to vote, who have maybe run into personal problems, I think that would we believe that would be truly beneficial. We did receive some calls with very specific problems. North Minneapolis, there were two polling locations that were very, very close to each other geographically. And as a consequence, there was a lot of confusion as to who was supposed to be where. It extended lines, confused voters, broken optical scanners, and disappointingly, a fair number of calls regarding voter intimidation in the Cedar Riverside neighborhood in North Minneapolis, and I'm sorry, in Minneapolis. We referred all of our calls to the Voter Protection Hotline, operated by Take Action, and Jonathan Maurer-Jones will be testifying on those issues specifically after I will. For the most part, the vast majority of Minnesotans who were able to vote without incident, but we really do remain concerned about confusion surrounding in-person absentee voting through an agent, timely voting registrations not received or processed by the county or state, and inadequately trained election judges or poll workers. Leguin Voters is dedicated to continue to working with the county election officials to get out information. We do some independent training of election judges and have worked with other organizations, and we remain dedicated to do so. We continue to get out information through our voter guides and our voter information hotline, and we continue to do that work, and we'll continue to do so. We know from all of our work and some of the work that we traveled. I recently attended the Pew Center on the States conference in Washington, D.C., looking forward to forward elections, elections in this country. And the fact remains that really looking at other secretaries of state, looking at what's going on in their practices, the idea of election day is sort of obsolete. Between early voting, in-person absentee, and all these different mechanisms by which people can vote over a greater range of time in different locations, we've got to make sure that these processes are fair and equitable. We look to the legislature and this committee in particular to be that charge and to be the defense for these voters. Voting is not a privilege granted only to the well-informed, the well-organized, the college-educated, people with photo ID and adequate personal transportation. Voting is a right for every eligible Minnesotan, no matter what side of the digital divide they reside upon, whether they were within or outside the mainstream, whether they reside in a shelter or residing someplace else post-foreclosure. We thank you for the opportunity to testify and look forward to working with you towards a more effective democratic process.
Are there questions or comments from Ms. Gaskins?
Madam Chair?
Senator Betzel.
And as to your comment about the precinct locations being, you know, a block away, I'm sure there's other situations around the state. Just in my area up in Blaine, we've got two churches right next door to each other, and there are different precinct location voting places. And unfortunately, the way you have to do it is because the legislature doesn't draw those boundary lines, but you've got overlapping city ward lines, you've got school district lines, you've got the legislative boundaries and so forth, and everyone has to be a different precinct. But trying to find not only where the lines are, but finding a suitable voting place within those lines gets to be really problematic. And so sometimes you just have to say, well, here's where the voting place is going to be, and then we'll draw the lines around them to make it fit. I don't know if there's any other way to do it. Has your organization thought about, you know, ways that we could try to make that a better work? Because it is confusing, because somebody say, well, I live right across the street from this place, but I got to go, you know, 2 miles the other way to vote.
Well, Senator Betzel, you know, the law, first of all, does say that the polling place needs to be inside the precinct. But lacking that, and certainly it's true, I think, in a number of suburbs, maybe not in Minneapolis or St. Paul, that there is no public building, first of all. And so even though some people object to voting in churches because they have a strong sense of separation of church and state, nevertheless, that is a quasi-public building. And in my city, there are
three polling places, a church and two schools within five blocks of one another. Each of them is a polling place for a different precinct because the other two precincts don't have, not only don't have a public building, they don't have a church in them either. And so, and there is a requirement that the polling place be within a certain distance of the precinct line. So you can't even, you can't go 5 miles or 2 miles from your precinct and still vote. They have to find a spot that, even if it's outside the precinct, that's close enough to make, to not be a violation of the statutes. Yeah. Last year we explored having polling places that weren't schools because we heard from a number of school districts that they were concerned for security issues for their for the children in those schools, and not just the elementary ones, also the high schools. And yet, we also do not permit, other than on an emergency basis, for a police officer to be stationed at a polling place because that's considered voter intimidation. So there are any number of conflicting values about where people vote and when they can vote that come into play, and they're not only two voting places next to one another that are for four different precincts that are nevertheless in the same precinct probably, is that would be the same situation that occurs in New Hope.
Madam Chair and Senator Ms. Gaskins. Without comment on the issues that Madam Chair identified, in some of these cases, simply having a poll worker, an election judge outside, so voters can identify is this where I'm supposed to be before standing in line for 2 or 3 hours, and then
the greeter judges, Ms. Smith,
and so those types of mechanisms would eliminate some of those problems and issues. But without question, where the law only provides a morning to vote. And employers can be extremely rigid, as we've heard testimony before, about what that morning means. It can create real serious problems for people attempting to vote.
Thank you. Any other question, comment? Thank you very much, Ms. Gaskins. We appreciate the work done by Legal Women Voters, and I am a proud member.
Thank you.
For many years. Next, I would like to invite Mr. Sulem from the Minnesota Townships Association. Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sulem, General Counsel with the Minnesota Association of Townships, and thank you very much for the invite to be here today. It's a lot harder for us to be able to find a specific township officer to come down and testify, so we appreciate the opportunity to speak on their behalf. I'm very happy to say that this year, probably in my almost 9 years with the Township Association, reflects the year that I've had the fewest number of election calls, and I did check with my one coworker as well, and he too had received far fewer phone calls about the election than we have in previous years, which we took as a sign that things were working pretty well. The types of calls that we tend to get also are the type that aren't the ones that can be fixed legislatively. When you've got 1,800 township officers administering an election in consultation with 87 county auditors, and some of them partnering up with their city officials to share or combine a polling place, it's inevitable that you're going to have a situation where there's a difference of opinion as to exactly what a rule or a statute means. But thankfully, we've got very good resources at the Secretary's office with the county auditors, and we tend to encounter those issues. You know, we can get a dialogue going and usually find a consensus or a resolution, or if we realize there is some ambiguity, we can come back here and work on it. But this year, we really received very few complaints about the process or the setup. We do get calls about confusion about the type, the difference of the trainings required, the difference between an election official training versus the election judge training versus the head election judge training, and how all those have to try to work in consort with each other depending on which position you're holding. Again, I think the law is pretty clear on it. But there is just some confusion among the individuals. It's just a matter of getting the communications out. And working with the county auditors and the secretary's office, I think we resolved most of that. To that extent, you always get concerns about, I'd love to be an election judge, but that's an awful lot of extra time to donate, not only on election day, but all the extra training. You know, and there are those who would say, rather than having a set number of hours, focus on the topic and the issues, and if you can do it in 2 hours instead of 5 hours, great, so be it. You know, we haven't had any formal conversations or discussions on that type of thing, but again, those are things that we have good communications going and not major issues being raised. We do get a lot of calls and concerns about election judges simply feeling overworked and fatigued by the length of the day. There have been in the past some disagreements over whether or not you can have split shifts on election judges. I think mostly the accepted is yes, you can. Whether or not it works well in your community is a case-by-case determination. But that might be an area where it might be helpful in some of the rural areas to just clarify that you could have a split shift. Like I said, I think most of us accept that you can, but it might be an area to clarify. In addition, if you do that, we've had some townships that have requested they don't want spouses serving at the same time, and that's currently prohibited. But if you had split shifts, so one was working, say, the 7 to noon shift, and somebody else was the other spouse would work the noon to closing shift, that might create some flexibility to open up the pool of judges. However, this year was the first time we haven't had a lot of calls about shortage of judges. That used to be a very common complaint for us, that we're simply not finding anybody willing to serve. And this year, maybe it's just because of the level of excitement over the election, there seemed to be enough willing participants. I did receive a call about an election judge who was the only member of that particular party. I won't mention which party it was, but the only one on that particular party's list. And in the past, that judge had been verbally abusive to voters, and the clerk did not wish to appoint that person. And there was some confusion as to, is there really a process to deny a judge if they're the only one on the list and you still need to exhaust the list remedy? And we came up with some good arguments for it. And we also said, you know, maybe just talk to this person and really reaffirm that, hey, judges have very specific roles and you can't be abusive. You're supposed to be accommodating to the voters and hope for the best. I never got a call back, so I'm assuming it resolved itself. But that might be another issue that we could have some conversations on with the secretary's office about, you know, do we need to clarify if you have documented past problems with a judge, but they're the only one left on the list, do you actually still have to accept them or not? It hasn't been an out-of-control issue, so it isn't a top priority, but we were asked to just to identify some of the common or some of the issues that we do here, so I'm throwing it out for the purpose of the discussion and debate. Other than that, the main thing that we'd like to stress is to keep in mind that in the rural areas in particular, we don't have the luxury of an election director. We don't have a full-time position. What we have are well-intentioned volunteers, both serving as the clerk and therefore the default election official and as the election judges. They are human beings. They mean well. They go to the training. They do the best. But there are going to be mistakes that happen from time to time. We need to keep that in mind and look at it. Was this an intentional problem? Was it just a mistake that can be corrected with some conversations? Was it a massive problem, or was it the isolated incident that no matter what the law says, you're not going to resolve completely because they are human beings? And to that extent, I don't know what specific proposals are going to be moving this year by other groups, but we would keep that in mind that sometimes there are well-intentioned efforts by associations thinking this will really help all voters, but if it makes the process so complex for the judges and the election officials, you can have, in particular in the rural areas, you'll find it very difficult to recruit those people. And if you think you have election problems with a well-intentioned judge, wait till you don't have any judges and see the free-for-all. So, you know, just remember as proposals start coming forward that we do need to keep that balance in mind, that it might sound like a good theory, but if it make it so complex for the judge or the election officials, we're going to see less and less willing to serve in the rural areas, and that's going to have its own set of consequences.
Mr. Sulem, one of the suggestions has been, you know, we do allow mailing ballots in very small jurisdictions, and one of the suggestions that has come forward has been to
increase the population that would permit a mail-in ballot. And I certainly would welcome, as time goes on this session, the experience of townships with regard to that. And if they support it, at what level of population would that make sense, either for townships and or small cities?
Madam Chair, I think that's an excellent issue, because this year I did have a few calls. I don't know the statistics. I would defer to the Secretary's office or the counties that might have better numbers. But I do believe there were a number of townships in the rural counties that did move to mail balloting.
They're not required to,
no.
But they were permitted to.
And it seemed to work very well from the township perspective. I don't know if the counties had any issues, because at that point there's some shared administrative roles that go on above and beyond some of the other stuff. But it seemed to work very well. Extremely high participation rate. I believe it was at Lake or Cook that took top honors for percentage turnout in the state. And it's 99% mail balloting, I believe, so you do get very high participation rate. The one thing I would say is that it would need to remain an option instead of a mandate, right, because we do have some town officers that feel very strongly that you have a civic duty to come to the polling place. If you want to take the effort, you ought to come and vote, and that people fought hard for that, and they don't want to make it too easy of an out to have a mandate. But having the option is definitely something I think would be very beneficial to a number of communities.
Are there any questions or comments? I'll start with Senator Roebling and then Senator Betzel.
Thank you. Some of my township clerks complained that about these lists, and they said that there were some of their longtime judges who didn't realize they had to contact the county to get on a list if they didn't go to their precinct caucuses or something. And I didn't know how to answer this, because they said that they were given lists from the county, and they were supposed to call for judges off of that and send them to the training, and the lists were quite extensive. We had a lot of people sign up, and so their concern was that they were choosing judges like for Credit River Township from Belle Plaine Township, because they were on the list and they couldn't go outside of the list, they didn't think, that they were given until they had already used everyone up on the list, which would never happen. And I'm just wondering if that was accurate, because they said that was their understanding of how the law was interpreted, and they said, you have to change the law, because we think we should have judges from our own township.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, that is definitely an issue. And if you recall, in the 2008 session, one of the bills that passed is that for township March elections, we are now exempted from that list. But that's township only. For the state November elections and the primaries, if there are would be a primary that involved a township, we are still tied to that list. It was expanded a little bit to give a little more flexibility once you have party balance, so you can get the nonpartisan judges as long as you've maintained some party balance. But at least for the initial start, you have to have exhaust that list, and it varies dramatically. And the lists, as I read the statute, and again, this is an area where you'll see some disagreement, the lists are controlled by the parties. They're not controlled by the counties. They're not controlled by the locals. The parties are supposed to submit the list to the county, and then the counties to turn around and submit that list to the local election officer, who then submits the list to their governing board to appoint the final list of judges. I can tell you anecdotally that we get calls from townships that say, well, our county added names or took names off. I will defer to the counties as to where they find that authority. I personally do not see it. My reading of the statutes is a straight pass-through from the parties. But that's been an issue for a long time, that we say that the process of getting on the list, because we've one of our town officers and board members been very active with her party for years, never misses a caucus, and has never succeeded in getting on her list, no matter how many times she signs up. She just cannot get her name added to that list. And so, again, it's not a township-specific issue, but I think it would be an excellent discussion to talk about how that election judge list comes about. But right now, my reading of the statute is that it's strictly party-controlled.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling?
Since the folks from the Secretary of State's office are here, if they have the answer, could they give us an answer to it? Because I really am wondering about these lists, too. And if we're looking for people that may be nonpartisan, but they're thinking that they have to exhaust the list first, then you're never going to get to any of the other nonpartisan people who might want to be election judges but don't go to caucuses.
Ms. Fraser?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling,
Ms. Fraser, you need to identify yourself.
Beth Fraser with the Secretary of State's office. I don't have the statute in front of me, but my memory of it is that the parties do create the lists and pass them to the counties, and the counties are supposed to pass the appropriate names to the municipality. And so we believe that means that they could limit it to, they would only pass on to Prior Lake the people with a Prior Lake address. And then the municipality does need to exhaust the list before they go on to hire other judges who aren't on the list. There was a proposal last year to get rid of the requirement to exhaust the list or even to have the parties submit lists. And that proposal was vetoed in 2007, and in 2008, in negotiations with the governor's office, they insisted that the list be exhausted. So we tried to get rid of the requirement that the list be turned in or at least be exhausted before other judges could be used. Many, from our understanding, is that many local election officials have people that have done it for years that they'd like to use, but if they don't turn up on the list and they don't need as many people as are on the list, that sometimes they can't get to the people that actually have the experience and knowledge. I know that, as Ms. Reichert explained, that they view this as a hiring process and do have qualifications. And so they send information to everyone on the list, but if they don't fill out the applications and meet the qualifications, then, you know, they don't feel like they have to hire the people on the list. They just need to send them information. So, which hopefully is a fairly accurate interpretation of what Ms. Reichert said.
Mr. Bonner, do you have that statutory reference, and is it, as Ms. Fraser explained? Anything you could add?
Madam Chair, I do have it in front of me. It's Section 204B.21, and I think she has paraphrased it accurately.
So,
Senator Roebling?
So the county election official does not have to give the whole list to a township for the whole county. And that apparently was what was happening. And, you know, a county is a pretty big place. So they were thinking that they had to call the people from other townships or cities who were in Scott County that were on that list before they could run out of them in their own precinct.
Madam Chair, Senator
Fraser.
Senator Roebling, that is our reading of the statute. Now, the lists are not always provided to the counties in a very user-friendly format. Our understanding is that often it's a photocopy of a handwritten sign-in sheet from a precinct caucus that's 3 months old, mm-hmm. or it's not necessarily in a format where it's easy for the county to split it up. I also understand that at some points the parties have turned over a statewide list to the counties, which then makes it hard to exhaust the list and also means that you might not be calling someone just further away in Scott County. They might feel they need to call someone in St. Louis County, which doesn't make a lot of sense.
Madam Chair, if I may, and that is an exact scenario we've had where the county, whether or not they have the authority, if the county forwards the list and it's a statewide list, then that is the list that needs to get exhausted. So it is, regardless of the issue with the county may or may not do with the list, once it's forwarded, that's what the local official has to exhaust. And we do have situations where they have received statewide lists. So we had a situation where somebody in the far northwest had a name from somebody in the Rochester area. Now, the hope is that person's going to say, no, I'm not going to spend 12 hours driving up to serve as a judge. But under the current statute, you'd be obligated to contact them and exhaust the list before you move off.
It seems to me that it begs for clarification, mm-hmm. yeah, even if we still want the parties to do lists and to have them exhausted first, we certainly don't need a statewide
we need some more direction to the folks sending those letters out that or those lists out that they need to be practical. Anything further for Mr. Sulems? Senator Betzel.
Just one question or comment. This past election, we heard some comparison with other states that allowed early voting where they people had the polls open a few days before the election and they could go vote then as opposed to election day. It seems to me that this would be quite a difficult thing for, you know, the cities and the suburbs to do, but it sounds like an almost impossible task for the townships if we allowed the polls to be open on days other than election day. Is that what I'm hearing, Mr. Sulem?
Mr. Sulem?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, I think if we were to look at that, we'd end up primarily using the county as the polling place, and it would be an extra burden for them. If you're talking about having to have each polling place open, yes, you would definitely have a next to impossible burden to overcome to have each individual township polling place open multiple days. The clerks are not full-time clerks. They, you know, trying to get that one extra day is, you know, enough effort. And I think at that point we'd have to be working very closely with our county friends and looking at having a designated site. And I will defer to the counties as to how they'd want to address that type of situation.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Sulem. Ms. Fraser, I'd like to invite Gwen Myers, an election judge from the city of Minnetonka, to join us. And you also have her written testimony in your packets. Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Gwen Myers. I'm a volunteer lobbyist with the League of Women Voters, but I'm here today as the election judge exhibit, I believe. For many years, I taught high school social studies and mostly government, and upon retirement, one of the first things I did was to volunteer as an election judge. I have served in every statewide election since the fall of 2000, but I have never served as a head judge. That's a job I don't wish to take on. The most important observation I have to make echoes Senator Carlson's concern. The average election judge is expected to work 16, 18, 20 hours or more. The head judge will work longer than the rest of us because he or she must take the ballots and the endless envelopes and all of the paraphernalia back to City Hall and check everything in. It's foolish to expect people to work these hours and to perform flawlessly, especially in the last 2 to 4 to 6 hours when so many important duties requiring precision are performed. I cannot testify to the fatigue from personal experience because the City of Minnetonka allows election judges to work half a day, an option which I have always taken. I get the 2 o'clock to whenever shift. I can testify to the care needed in closing the polls. There are a number of details that must be handled, numerous counts that must be verified. Ballots have to be stored in particular boxes or particular envelopes. These final details account, I think, for many of the problems we have heard about and will continue to hear about in our recount procedure. And you've got to realize that people are doing these counts and making these decisions after starting work at 6 o'clock in the morning, which means they got up, Lord knows when. The second observation is that we really should broaden the spectrum of items which an individual may use to prove his or her identity for same-day election registration. We do not allow people to use out-of-state driver's licenses as a photo ID, for example. This is a problem for many. In order to get a Minnesota driver's license, a person's required to take a written test. This is a perfectly reasonable requirement, but it delays the acquisition of the Minnesota license. Others do not have utility bills in their name. I was presented with bank statements, Visa bills. One woman brought in a pile of mail with a rubber band around it, hoping something in there. She just knew she needed to have a piece of mail. Nothing fit. You know, so none of these things work. And in these cases, an election judge is sometimes hard put to find a way that will allow an individual to vote, although I had no doubt these people lived in the district. They were citizens. They should be allowed to vote. Vouching often was the only way, and in most of the cases, We were able to find somebody who lived in the same building, or they could call a relative or something. But it's just heartbreaking when they've gone to the trouble and then can't vote. The last observation is that we must find a better way to deal with absentee ballots. We were lucky in Minnetonka Precinct 2C, and that the only time we were really busy with lines out the door and down the block was in the morning. The rest of the day was steady but not overwhelming, and this was fortunate because mid-afternoon we had an enormous number of ballots, absentee ballots arrive, and we could spare the necessary two judges. You need a Republican and a Democratic judge to process these ballots, and we also took a lot of the head judge's time as well. So we were able to get most of it done before 8 o'clock. Other years, this work was all done after the polls closed. Had that been the case this year, given the number of absentee ballots, we would have been there till midnight or later. There are several things I know that can be done to mitigate this, and I hope that these will be considered in this session. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon, and if you have any questions, I'll try and answer them.
Are there any questions or comments for Ms. Myers? We certainly want to thank you for your service. You might consider yourself the election judge's exhibit, but there are thousands of you across the state, and we wouldn't really be able to have a democratic society without people willing to serve in that way. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
At least as currently we have it. Next, I would like to invite Patsy Green, the chair of the Robbinsdale School Board, Independent School District 281, and Mr. Kroonquist from the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. Welcome to the committee, Chair Green. And if you'd identify yourself, please, for the record, we'll be pleased to have your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair Rust and members of the committee. I am Patsy Green, and I am a member of the Robbinsdale School Board. As of Monday night, I am no longer chair. I passed the gavel to another very qualified school board director. But during the election, I was chair of the Robbinsdale School Board. And I want to thank you for this opportunity to share what the Robbinsdale School District experienced on election day of voters receiving the incorrect ballots. As Senator Rest and Senator Betzel talked about earlier, you know, a lot of the precincts have divisions within their voting locations based upon, with us, it was school district lines. And historically, the Robbinsdale School District holds their elections on the off or odd years, and this is the first time in recollection that they had held an election on and had a question on the ballot during an even year general election. So this was a new experience for us. We usually have very quiet elections. But Tuesday morning on the election day, I received a call from a voter who, while driving to work after voting, realized she had not been able to vote on our referendum and was confused. She called her city clerk and was told, "You must have received a wrong ballot. It's too late to do anything. You cannot, you know," because she had already, you know, submitted her ballot. And the city clerk did confirm that she had received one other call from a voter that realized they had received the wrong ballot and couldn't do that. This person then called the election clerk at the school district, who was very sympathetic, but said, you know, actually the cities at that point run the election. The city clerks are responsible for running the precincts, and she kind of oversees it from the school district part. I was the third call, and she just wanted to make sure the school board was aware that this happened and that the campaign was aware of what happened. And it was a very interesting day from there on forward.
By campaign, you mean the advocates for the referendum.
The advocates for the referendum, yes. What we know is that there are precincts in some of our communities that are served by more than one school district. We have some precincts that are served by up to four school districts. So the election judges had to differentiate between the ballot and where the people live, what ballot they should get. I know one of the city managers personally said with her and her son color-coded the ballots according to the school districts before the election day. She said there were like 3,000 ballots they worked through. And this led to some confusion and people receiving incorrect ballots in two communities of our school district that I know of, actually. And what concerns me is we heard from a handful of voters that this happened to, but there are people who probably didn't realize it until later and didn't say anything, or some people that maybe never realized. You know, those ballots are long during a general election. So we have concerns about what happened. And we hope the numbers are small. We're guessing that they were small because we didn't have much feedback. But I'd like to just finish. I'll be very brief with a small anecdote that happened on election day. And it wasn't long after I received that call that calls and emails started flying around the school district because there was a lot of concern about how big an issue this was going to become for us. After the calls and emails, the blog started. And, of course, those of us that were very engaged in the outcome of the election, we were tracking this, all communication, all blogs that we could, very closely. And about middle of the afternoon, a blog popped up, a response to the blog that said, you know, I live in that community, but I live in the other school district. And I received a ballot with the Robbinsdale referendum on the ballot. And just want to let you know that I voted yes for your referendum. So we were feeling kind of good. We had one back. So thank you. That's my brief story about what we experienced in the Robbinsdale School District. And as Senator Rest mentioned, I am joined by Scott Kronquist from the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. And we'll take questions.
Sure. First of all, who is this is my school district. Who is a new chair?
Tom Walsh.
Tom Walsh. Great. Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, my nieces go to school in the school district, so the referendum was of interest to me, too. But you won the referendum. By what kind of margin?
Well, we had two questions on the ballot. The first question won by 55% to 45%. The second question won by about a 5% margin, about 53 to 47%. You know, fractions in there. So we were thrilled with the outcome.
Right. And because the outcome was so significant, the issue that Ms. Green brings up is only a curiosity, right, if you will. I mean, we don't want it to happen, but it's only a curiosity. What if the referendum had failed by 5 votes?
Right.
Or had passed by 5 votes, what then?
Right.
I mean, there would have been, talking about an election contest, I think the issue would have been in the courts because there would have been people coming forward saying, I got the wrong vote, and I voted, like this person said, I voted in a referendum that it was illegal for me to vote in.
Right.
And or I voted and I was not given the correct ballot. I am sure there would have been a contested election if that, because it was important for people who supported it and it was important for people who opposed it, that the issue would have gone to the court. So I think, I don't know how you rectify that other than by having people who are driven by detail to make sure that it doesn't happen, but it could have been serious.
Well, Madam Chair, do you think this was exacerbated because it was in the general election year? Like, had it been in the odd year when your referendums usually are, you would have had maybe a lighter turnout and more time for election judges to make sure that people were getting the proper ballot.
Or if it was only the referendum, but as you're indicating, but there is some suggestions for eliminating all for costs, eliminating all odd year elections for municipalities and for school districts. Now, the only time other than the general election
where school districts are involved is where there's a bond issue rather than an operating referendum. But school, but cities have their elections in odd years. And if they all had their elections in even years and, you know, did some sort of juggling of the terms for the first time you did that, it would be a huge cost savings. So that's an idea that's being bounced around, too. Mm-hmm. Mr. Kronquist, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Well, Madam Chair, Scott Kronquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. Just to emphasize your point, last year, a year ago, 2007, there was a school referendum that failed by 9 votes. So, you know, your point is well taken that in that kind of situation, yeah, if something like this arises, it could literally sway the election one way or the other, which is why we thought it was important just to raise this issue.
It.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments for Ms. Green or Mr. Kronquist? Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair, and I'm not sure who wants to answer this, but so in that precinct where you said that you had 4 school districts, do you keep the ballots separate at all, or are they all commingled? So, and I guess a follow-up to that is, if there were a very close contest with the bond issue, does that trigger a recount?
Madam Chair and Senator Carlson, I am not that intimately involved in the actual election process, so I can't answer that question for you. I would refer to either the city clerk or the clerk at our school district.
Okay. But, you know, you said that the ballots were colored by earlier in the day.
They used a magic marker.
Right, Madam Chair and Senator Carlson. They just used a magic marker to color code them.
Mr. Secretary, doesn't that constitute a stray mark on a ballot?
Invalidate the vote.
That phase is over.
Clearly, we're going to have to address that issue. I don't know what the solution is, but that just really shouldn't happen. We can all probably think of very complicated ways to make sure that you get the right ballot, but the idea would be to make it simple. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry I missed the beginning of this, but was there any discussion of changing precinct lines? Because the precinct lines we require to address the county lines, the city lines, everything else, but legislative district lines, congressional district lines. Has anybody ever talked about that you're aware of making them fit school district lines?
Senator Marty, the redistricting takes into account the communities of interest, and school districts is one of them, but it does not trump.
Right.
Madam Chair, that's why I'm saying the precinct lines, which are drawn locally, are required to meet all those other ones, and why school
that's
boards
true.
Are excluded right. is a good question. Not that that makes it, I had a precinct at one time that was like 2 blocks long because mm-hmm. between congressional districts,
right.
legislative districts, it just required that. But it seems to me we could make that addition, and I don't think it's mm-hmm. going to happen in that many school districts, but if it does, it would unfortunately mean more precincts, presumably, mm-hmm. or more lopsided numbers in precincts.
Well, yeah, and that is the case from my district, too. In one precinct, I have 2 school districts, and in another precinct, one in Plymouth, there are at least 2. Yeah. And there might be, and in some other precincts, there might be more than that. But they didn't divide them. Anything else? Thank you very much.
You.
Appreciate your testimony.
You,
I'd like to invite Jonathan Howard Jones from Take Action Minnesota and the Minnesota Voting Rights Coalition to join us.
School district, yes.
Welcome to the committee, and if you'd please identify yourself for the record.
Yep. Thanks, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Howard Jones.
Thanks again for hearing testimony on what worked in our election system this past year and where there are barriers that still need to be addressed. I lead the democracy program at Take Action Minnesota, and which is a coalition of 32 organizations and more than 4,000 individuals who work year-round to advance social, racial, and economic justice. And core to our mission is our work to register and turn out voters and ensure that all eligible voters can participate in the election system. Take Action also convenes the Minnesota Voting Rights Coalition, and which is a group of about 20 organizations that work to remove barriers that make it difficult for people to participate. And we've worked on bills in this committee in the past, and there are also several other coalition members here today, too. But I'm here before you because for the 2008 election, Take Action Minnesota led a broad coalition of groups in a statewide nonpartisan election protection effort. We had our trained attorneys and interpreters answered more than 1,100 phone calls from voters who had questions or problems. And we also had trained volunteers stationed in 135 targeted precincts in 32 cities around the state on Election Day. And we also did some recruiting. We recruited 65 people, 20 of whom were bilingual, to serve as election judges and provided kind of a supplementary training for those folks to help prepare them for the role. And so with all of this, we had a front seat to how Election Day 2008 went, and it was a lot of the reports that we were collecting that generated media coverage on the day of the election. So our perspective is that overall, the 2008 elections were a success in terms of the process. For the most part, the system worked, and it was free from serious problems that turned away large numbers of voters. And so great credit to the Secretary of State's office, to local election officials around the state who did incredible work to ensure that we were ready for the turnout and that we had a fair and inclusive process. But that said, Election Day was not without some important issues that made it difficult for voters. Out of the calls we received on Election Day, 132 of them were reports of problems voters faced, and we considered 77 of those to be serious problems. Some of the stories from the day, an election judge in Hopkins told a voter that he could not vote because he didn't speak English well, and therefore he clearly could not be a citizen. Again, as Ms. Gaskins mentioned earlier, there was those two precincts in North Minneapolis that were very close together. There was actually a third precinct that was only another four blocks or so from those two. So we ended up dispatching some folks to those precincts to post maps that showed where the precinct boundaries were to try to clear up some of the confusion. We received reports from voters in Bloomington, Brooklyn Park, St. Paul, and elsewhere from voters who were not advised by election judges of some of the options for same-day registration. And some of these voters reported they were not allowed to register using a voucher. And then we also heard some reports of interpreters and party challengers, again, the problem with challengers, trying to influence voters' choices, and even in some cases, folks assisting voters were allegedly marking the ballot contrary to the intent of the voters. There were reports of long lines, polling places running out of registration forms and pens, polling places opening late. But we view most of these things we view as isolated incidents or kind of individual mistakes that didn't seem part of a systematic suppression effort. And that's a good thing. But there were a couple trends that I wanted to mention that I think deserve some attention and action as we move forward through the session. We received I was startled by the number of voters from St. Paul, Minneapolis, Robbinsdale, Brooklyn Center, Alexandria, and some other cities that didn't show up on the voter rolls, even though voters were convinced that they had registered validly in advance. And in some of the cases, it was even voters who had voted in the same place in past elections. They didn't show up on the list. And We don't really know why these voters weren't on the list, and so, you know, I think it is an important thing as we go forward to continue improving the registration process, make sure that voters get onto the list, that they stay on the list, to, you know, reduce confusion for voters and also to relieve some of the burden of Election Day. Some of the voters were able to re-register if they had the right documents, but some did not have the documents they needed with them because they thought they were set. We believe considering a system for automatic registration could help to alleviate some of these things and so improving the process. Another trend that we saw was that many of the problems at the polls seem to kind of stem from election judges who, again, don't fully either understand the law or are misapplying it or are tired after a long day and make mistakes. And for the most part, election judges do a tremendous job, and we need them desperately. And so, but we think we can do more to prepare judges so there are fewer problems and that voters have more support. As I said before, we started doing kind of a supplementary training for some of the judges that we were recruiting who were, many of them were first-time judges. Some were from communities of color who, you know, speak other languages, and people were really hungry for the kind of support that we could give with some more detailed training about incidents they might face. One of the other members of the Voting Rights Coalition is Somali Action Alliance also, and in the Somali community, they found a need for more bilingual election judges than were able to be filled this year, despite great efforts by the cities, by groups like Take Action and Somali Action. And so continuing to improve the process for election judges is a key thing, too. And finally, one issue we haven't talked about yet, but that we think is critical. We received more than 25 calls from voters who were confused and needed clarification about the rules about when a person is eligible to vote if they have a felony. There's a significant amount of confusion in the community about this. If anyone has, I suspect many of you have knocked on doors recently, and you come across people all over who think that you are never able to vote again. And the act of disenfranchising people has a huge impact, especially on certain communities of color, the African American community particularly. So continuing to improve the information that's out there and doing a better job of notifying voters that they when they can vote again, and looking at moving forward when people are able to vote again would improve things as well. So I appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation about the election. I look forward to working with the committee and the legislature on some of these issues going forward, and to, you know, continue, again, addressing the barriers voters face and to move toward a fully inclusive democracy. And I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Miller-Jones. Are there comments or questions? Senator Pappas.
Just real quickly, Madam Chair. What is the procedure for getting your voting rights back if you're a felon? Because my voter registration efforts have been in downtown St. Paul in the last couple elections, and other groups have done other parts of my district, so I don't run into too many felons in downtown St. Paul. But I'm curious.
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, there isn't a procedure that people have to go through to restore their rights. They're automatically restored at the end of your sentence, including probation or parole. The problem is that many folks in the community don't know that. There's confusion from other states that take away the right to vote permanently. Voters, there's a guy that I know who found out in the 2006 election that he was able to vote again after about 18 years of being eligible but not knowing that he could. And so that exists in our community.
Thank you.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. And this might have to be answered by the Secretary Ritchie. If somebody sends in one of these and there is something wrong with it that disqualifies them from being registered, are they notified that their registration has not been accepted? Because I'm just trying to figure out about the people who thought they sent these in and found out that they weren't registered.
Senator, I'm going to ask Ms. Reichert to
come back and address that question, or Ms. Smith, if she's still here.
Yes, someone else than you,
because you'd be surprised at how much care they take of voters who are attempting to register who've made a mistake. Ms. Smith, want to tell them what happens?
Sure. Madam Chair, thank you. I'm Rachel Smith, the Anoka County Elections Manager. And typically in the state, the counties are responsible for inputting voter registration information. So that's why I'm up here. Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, basically, if we get a voter registration card, the two more popular reasons that we see that for whatever reason the voter forgot to fill out, which are make the card deficient, are date of birth and the signature. Those are two critical issues with voter registration that we see the most common. Name and address are usually filled out, but the date of birth or signature are missing. And we actually go to great length to try and notify the voters. We will call them, email them, depending on what they've provided on their application, or even sometimes if we have to do it, we'll do it by mail to return it, depending on the time. How much time do we have? How close is it before an election? But we do go to great length to try and get people registered. We do it all year round. But I will add that I think a voter should be able to know if they're registered or not. There should be somewhere that they can check if they're registered without needing to go through us, that they have access to that information.
So, Senator Roebling, they'll call them and say, you didn't sign your card. You got to come by and sign your card if you want to be registered. And they either do or they don't.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Maurer Jones or Senator Betzel?
Well, to follow up on that, you've got to get the registration in a certain number of days before the election. So, I mean, for those people who get in the registration just before the deadline, but if they have a technical error, then what do they do?
Well, as I understand it, they call them and tell them your registration is not going to be valid
because
it's too late.
Okay.
You have to register on election day.
Okay.
Right. Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. I was also wondering, I've heard that there were some big get-out-the-vote efforts, and did volunteers sometimes collect these voter registration, or do they leave them with the voter to mail in themselves, and do they, if they are collecting them, do they always get submitted?
Senator Roebling, League of Women Voters group, we took them to City Hall the next day. For those that didn't want,
within
that
10
wanted
days
to 10 save days. The money of the stamp, mm-hmm. You know, they left them with the volunteers, and we took them in the next day, and we had a count of how many we were taking in because we were interested in knowing how successful we were going to be. But it certainly is the case that if you leave it with a volunteer, you're not guaranteed that the card is going to make it.
Right. Madam Chair, if I may.
Maurer Jones.
Yeah, with our organization, we do a fair amount of voter registration as well, and usually we'll collect them from the voters, but then make also daily runs to the Secretary of State's office to drop off those cards. And so, of course, there isn't a guarantee that it's going to get in, with other efforts or whatever. But the other piece of this that I was more startled by, I think, was the folks who had voted in a place several times in the past and for whatever reason didn't show up on the list too. And so I don't have the answer to why that happened. I would hope that we can figure it out though.
In the past, there have been purges of the list, and that might have been the reason for some of them. We don't do that anymore, I guess. Senator Laurie?
Madam Chair, Mr. Maurer Jones, I was going to follow up on that. Those individuals who voted several times and contacted you, did you keep their names, and are you going to try to get individual explanations to see if there's a systematic problem here that might need redress? I mean, I would imagine answers should be available as to why they fell off of the list.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Laurie, we did keep a large database of all the calls and questions and complaints we received. Sometimes voters provided a name, sometimes they didn't. Sometimes we have contact information, sometimes we don't. I could imagine that some of them voted 8 years ago and that at that same precinct and then would be dropped from the list after 4 inactive years. But so there could be explanations in there. We have not done a lot of follow-up with them yet, but we have some information to do that with.
Good. Madam Chair, just one little brief comment. When I was doing voter registration, I found a lot of voters did not know that, they would tell me they were registered, and I would say at this address, because a lot of times they didn't realize they had to re-register if they moved. And, that was happening a lot. So I think there's some confusion about that, with irregular voters in particular.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your being with us today. Next, I would like to invite Holly Davis, Director of Research and Policy for the Minnesota State University Student Association, and Ryan Anderson, the President of the Minnesota State University Mankato Student Government. Welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you. I am Holly Davis. And
I'm Ryan Anderson.
Welcome.
So Minnesota State University Student Association represents students at the 7 state universities. We do a number of things, but including a lot of get out the vote work. Ryan will be speaking specifically about some of the things he encountered on campus, and I can talk more broadly about my work coordinating the entire state. So we did a number of activities, including voter registration. We registered over 6,000 students to vote. We did a lot of voter registration, including partnering with the League of Women Voters to distribute some of their candidate guides, and also, of course, getting students to the polls on Election Day. So overall, students had a very positive experience. We know that there was a significant increase in turnout, which we're always glad to see. And many of the recent changes in election law and the rules changes were a great help to students, and we very much appreciate all the efforts of this committee and others in that. However, there were some problems. Some students did experience some obstacles to voting. When we were doing our voter registration drive and also on Election Day, when we were talking to students, a number of students, as other individuals, did not know if they were registered to vote. And we were hoping to be able to check, to have a website or a phone number to call and verify. If this was before the registration deadline, we would generally tell them, if you're not sure, go ahead and register again. If it was on Election Day, try and prepare them to bring documents to register on Election Day. But again, as to echo other comments, it would be great if there was just a way to check that individuals could take control and be sure they're prepared as they go to the polling place. I think at this point, I'll turn it over to Ryan to talk about some specifics.
Okay. On Election Day, students attempting to register found several stumbling blocks. Some students, especially at schools near the border, I know in Mankato we serve a lot of students who live in Iowa and the Dakotas, assumed that they would be able to use their driver's license from another state to prove their identity. Many were surprised to find that the same driver's license that they used to prove their identity in many other situations was not valid to prove their identity at the polls. Other students had trouble producing a utility bill in their name because one roommate had all the bills in their name, leaving other roommates with no proof of residence. When this situation came up, students tried to provide their lease as a proof of residence and, of course, were turned down even though it is a legal document linking them to the residence. Last, there were a few students who had trouble when providing an itemized rent statement as proof of residence on Election Day. This is a new document that was added last year to the list of supported documents, a change that MSUSA supported. However, this year, when students went to the polls, there was some confusion about what a valid rent statement was, seeing as there is no standard for it. And as a result, students providing this document didn't always have it accepted.
So like I said earlier, overall, student voting experiences were very positive. However, we don't want to forget students who ultimately were not able to vote because of some of these obstacles. Particularly with young people, we know that voting is habit-forming. Once they vote in two elections, they're much more likely to be a lifelong voter, which I think is a goal we all agree on. So we do appreciate the opportunity today to talk about these issues and look forward to working with you throughout this session to hopefully find some solutions. I believe the committee administrator also has our written testimony if you'd like a copy. And thank you. We'd love to answer questions if you have them.
Are there comments or questions for Ms. Davis or Mr. Anderson? Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair, I'm curious as what percentage of the students would you say voted in their home area or voted in the where they were going to school?
I would say generally more of the students I talked to, over half. I'm not sure how far over half. A lot more of them voted on their campus.
because they identified more with the campus. Also, those students tended to be the ones in common areas and around sticking around campus a lot more. I imagine those that voted at home tended to either live at home or be less connected to their campus community and feel less identification there. Would you agree?
I guess I would say the only students who I knew specifically who voted at home voted because they knew a local official running, or they were very concerned about a local school board measure. But once students were informed, once students knew that they could vote where they lived at school, that was the option that they were in favor of.
Senator Pappas, wasn't that your bill at some point?
No. Thanks, I'll take credit for it.
On being able to use that rent statement, individual rent statement?
Didn't do that.
Might have been Higgins.
Senator Higgins did it. Okay, I'm sorry.
I just wanted to thank you for your work. You know, we had a tremendous turnout from students, and there were a lot of groups that were working to turn out students, and I'm just really proud that there was such a high interest in the election, and I hope that that continues in future elections.
Any other questions or comments? I would also like to thank you then for being with us, and we hope that we can address some of the issues that you raised and in legislation this session as well.
Thank you very much.
There being no further business, we are meeting on Friday at 10 a.m. in room 15 this time, on Friday, room 15 at 10 a.m.
Excuse me. On another committee with you.